About 8 months ago, I began a study in the book of Proverbs. Typically, the way in which I study is to spend a lot of time kind of thinking about the text, looking at it both inductively, looking at what other people have to say about it, and then to try and let it soak into myself a little bit before coming and trying to let you know a little of what God has said to me. Little did I know that the beginning part of this particular study of the book of Proverbs would happen against the context of the week that we've just had, both as a country and as a culture. We're looking at the first 7 verses where Solomon gives kind of his thesis and his supporting background for what this book is all about. I want you to read it aloud with me. So if you have your Bible, turn to Proverbs chapter 1. If you don't have the NIV version, take it out of the pew in front of you, and you can turn to page 663, and we're going to read aloud together Proverbs chapter 1, verses 1 to 7. Proverbs 1, verses 1 to 7. I believe that Solomon has collected and compiled the wisdom of his age. He has several reasons for doing that, and in these particular verses he gives us, among other things, what he sees the purpose of wisdom to be, what its foundation or center point is, the premise on which it's founded, and then we will not have time today, but he begins to give us some word pictures as to what wisdom looks like. So if you'll read along with me, we'll read Proverbs chapter 1, verses 1 to 7 together. The Proverbs of Solomon, son of David, king of Israel, for attaining wisdom and discipline, for understanding words of insight, for acquiring a disciplined and prudent life, for doing what is right and just and fair, for giving prudence to the simple, knowledge and discretion to the young, let the wise listen and add to their learning, and let the discerning get guidance. For understanding proverbs and parables, the sayings and riddles of the wise. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and discipline. What's fascinating to me in looking at the background, and we'll have chance to spend more time looking at the background of this book in later messages, what's fascinating is the parallel that Solomon faced in about the 10th century B.C. to the one that we face about the 20th century A.D. It was a time in Solomon's world where it seemed like the signposts of his culture were missing. I don't know if there's a kind of disorientation that's occurring in your life. No longer is Roger Maris the home run king. But instead we have 2 people, maybe even 3, that will be better than that icon. No longer is it true that we can see things that we thought to be stable, markers that somehow they weren't going to change. Lo and behold, it appears as though things that appeared stable are shifting and the ground is reeling underneath us. And if that's not true as a culture, it's very true as I talk to folks, some of you within this fellowship, other people in the community, it seems to be true in our age as well. I read the newspaper with a kind of a disorientation. Where is the way of wisdom? And it seems to me, as I've wrestled with this and thought about what Solomon's about in his age, because in the nation of Israel, Solomon is a pivot figure from his father David to the subsequent disorientation of what happened in that great nation. What happens is Solomon's a pivot person who initially came on the scene asking for wisdom and then abandoned what was given to him. Solomon is one of these people who remembers what Israel was like as an agrarian, a cultural, basically theocratic community where, among other things, people came together and then went apart year by year. But the nature of the society was basically a farming community. And within the time of his father David and Solomon's reign, Israel became a world power. People came from all over the place, such that Solomon sees the poignant temptation on the part of his sons. That's why he'll address them again and again, that they are abandoning their roots. And they're leaving off the wisdom that comes from knowing God. I don't know if that's true of the way you look at life, but certainly true of the way I see it. That there is at face value and underneath it all a struggle for what to hold on to as the sands of culture shift all around us. Underlying it are two basic questions or two themes. The first is the theme of relationship. Amidst the changes that occur, people seek connection with one another. They look out for folk who they can hold on to, grab hold of, who will give support to them in the midst of the changes of their life. The second, people look for wisdom. They look not just for information or data. Our culture is loaded with it. But piercing all that information, direction on how they should live. So our world is filled with interactive media methods and techniques. We have talk radio, talk television, internet chat rooms. We have all sorts of ways to try and help people connect and find direction for their life. In the ancient world, that happened by people coming together to share their collective wisdom. They did it in the form of proverbs. And these proverbs were meant to help people understand how they could relate better to the folks around them and how they could find wisdom for their age. So Solomon collects these. Some of them are given to him by God himself. And he brings them together, and in these seven verses he gives us his introduction, his goals, his assumptions, and he outlines to us what he hopes people who read this book will gain. First of all, he talks about wisdom's purpose. He next talks about its premise. That's verse 7. What the basic thesis, the main point will be. And then finally, he gives us a series of word pictures in chapters 1, 2, 3, and 4 about what wisdom looks like, what it is about. First of all, wisdom's purpose. In the main, Solomon says that wisdom is given to us by God for three reasons. To help people with right behavior, verse 3. We'll look in detail at that verse. Verse 4, with right beginnings, how people should start to gain a heart of wisdom. And finally, verse 5, with the correct or right balance. Verse 3, look at it together. He basically says, for acquiring a disciplined and prudent life for this purpose, doing what is right and just and fair. In the space of one line, Solomon opens up the whole realm of human behavior, the whole range of how we should live and how we should act. He uses three words, what is right and just and fair. Or in a more abstract way, he talks about morality, ethics, and values. Morality is judgments about what is right and wrong. Ethics has to do with what is correct or an incorrect course of action, the most expedient way to act. And fairness or values have to do what is best for the widest number of people. Now, suppose I want to get a car. I really would like to get a car. Let's not go into the reasons why. Suppose I want to get a car. If I'm going to do what's right, it means that as I'm thinking about getting a car, I'm going to buy it, not steal it. You understand that? That's morality. Secondly, if I'm going to do what's just, I'm going to enter into negotiations with the seller in a truthful and honest way. I'm going to represent the car that I trade in as being falling apart. Instead of, oh, it's got a nice wax job, doesn't it? I'm going to enter into a conversation with the person I buy and sell with the highest ethical standards. And fairness. That means suppose after I bought the new car, I discover under the seat a Mark McGuire rookie card. It's becoming very valuable. Suppose I find a family heirloom in the trunk. Fairness. I basically am going to go back to the dealer back to the seller and say, I only bought the car. I didn't buy the card. I didn't buy the heirloom. Why? Because the fair thing for me to do is to return the things I didn't buy to the person that I did it with. Some of the teens around town and from camp and other places, some of you even are wearing these little bracelets called What Would Jesus Do? One of those students to me said to me this past week, you know, I kind of got a victory. I said, how did that happen? A test was returned and my teacher didn't mark off an answer I got wrong. So I pointed it out to her. The rest of the kids in my class said, you're crazy. Why'd you do that? Because it's fair. What's right and just and fair. The way of wisdom begins, and all of a sudden Solomon says, if you want to know how to live life in the correct way, you will live life by reading these proverbs to understand what is right and just and fair. Now I ask you to examine your own life at this point and the affairs of this past week. Is that how you've lived your life? Well, Solomon goes on. He's not just concerned with these outer sorts of things, but he says, among other things, I'm not really good either at getting cars or doing life. In fact, I look at my life and I realize that I've blown it a lot. I'm not a particularly wise person when it deals to other people. I've made mistakes. What is these proverbs have for me? And basically Solomon says, but if you read these proverbs, verse 4, look at it with me, these proverbs will give prudence to the simple and knowledge and discretion to the young. The second purpose of Solomon's work is to help the simple and the young to begin correctly. Solomon has a passion that folk who are new to this idea of life, and it doesn't make too much difference how old you are as a person, chronologically, you can be new in just this idea of figuring out that life ought to be lived a particular way. That this sort of thing, these proverbs are helpful by reading, studying, and obeying the words that will continue later on. We will gain prudence, knowledge, and discretion. Now again, some definitions. Prudence has to do with that side of wisdom that involves shrewd judgments and cleverness. That's what the Hebrew word means. Knowledge has to do with the assembling of facts, data, in a particular way. Remembering what's gone before, assembling that information together. And discretion, I think in some of your versions it may be translated insight, has to do with deciding on the best procedures for achieving one's goal. You see, I still want to get this car. And I've decided that I'm not going to steal it. I've decided that I'm going to be truthful in my dealings, and I'm going to return any heirlooms I find in the trunk. Because I want to be, according to verse 3, I want to be one of these people who is right and just and fair. But these words add a whole nother dimension to the way of wisdom. Prudence means that as I go to talk to the person who's going to buy the car, I'm not going to be swayed by the first sales pitch. You see? I'm going to comparison shop. I'm going to be prudent in my dealings. Knowledge is that I'm going to research everything I can about this particular vehicle. I'm going to figure out what the blue book value is. I'm going to surf the internet to find out what the dealer cost is. I'm going to get my data up to speed. And discretion, insight. I'm going to invite God to give me insight into the situation, the person that's selling it. Whether, in fact, I even need the car at this point. Because Solomon is concerned not just with right behavior, but with right beginnings. Now in verse 5, he adds the third dimension of wisdom's purpose. Wisdom is given to us not just to help us with behavior and beginnings, but it's given to us so that, among other things, we will have the right balance to life. If you look at verse 5, it ought to rivet you. Read it again with me. Let the wise listen and add to their learning. Let the discerning get guidance. Solomon's third purpose for meditating on these sayings is that it gives balance to life. The fascinating thing for me is that I find folk who start well and then stop becoming wise. I was reading that comic strip Shoe, and the editor of Shoe's newspaper is sitting at the bar or the restaurant, and he says, "I'm not getting better. I'm getting, next frame, bitter." And I find it fascinating as I get older that it's easy to say, "I've learned enough. I know it all. I don't need to keep growing." Solomon says, no, that what's true about life is that we are always in the stage where we need more wisdom. In fact, he invites those who are wise, as compared to the foolish, the young, and the simple, to gain further wisdom. And I want to invoke those of you who have been on the way a bit, never, never think that you've got it all together. In fact, one of the crying needs, the crying concerns of the youth culture of our day is not so much of information about what happened before and how you did life 20 or 30 years ago. What they're looking for is a life of authenticity to see how you're walking with God right now. And Solomon has that same concern as well. He says, "Let the wise listen and add to their learning. Let the discerning get guidance." The word guidance is a fascinating word. We could have done word studies on almost all the words of these seven verses. But the word guidance has the idea of a nautical term. It's the idea of rudder steering a ship. And you know when a ship is on the high seas, the rudder is integral to its performance. You never stop needing the rudder. And it's true of your life, true of mine, that we never stop needing guidance in our life. So why is that important? Solomon will go on to suggest in a variety of ways in the rest of the book that at each stage of life there's a different sort of wisdom required. No matter what stage you're at now, you're going to need more wisdom at the next stage. As I visit folk who are toward the end of life, who are older, they say that the old age is not for sissies. It's for folk who need wisdom to know how to act appropriately. Unless wisdom is received and transferred intergenerationally, what ends up happening is that if the older generation doesn't give wisdom to the younger generation, they consign the younger generation to a prison of the present. And I want to ask you, to what degree are you involved in transferring the wisdom that God's given you to the generations to come? What's fascinating to me about even the slide report this morning is that all of a sudden, as kids went to a place that was so totally different than the place they lived, they learned things about their world and about God. The response of each of us should be to go and grab some of those kids when they come out of the teen department and say, "That's right on. Keep learning. Don't give up." Thirdly, there's always a temptation within our culture to substitute technique for wisdom, innovation for insight, for doing things right, for doing the right things. Some of you don't have to read too far between the lines to understand that's precisely the debate that faces our nation right now. And Solomon's concern is that those who are wise would continue to add to their wisdom, and that those who have discretion would be able to steer their course in a way that makes a difference for the younger generation. Oh, one of my prayers is that God would keep me from being an old fuddy-duddy. I want to be in touch with life. Now, unfortunately, it doesn't always work that way. In my younger days, when I had more hair and more resistance, you see, I used to swim breaststroke for high school and college. You need to know that breaststroke is one of the competitive strokes that's gone through the most innovation. You don't need to know that. I'm just telling you that that's the way it is, okay? And so much so that I cannot swim breaststroke the way they currently teach it. It's much faster now. The times are unbelievable. In fact, the record times for breaststroke now have dropped more in the last 20 years than for any other stroke. You know, I can't teach breaststroke. But, you know, I can teach the mindset for competitive swimming. And you see, us swimmers have proverbs, and what we talk about is, you don't need to breathe, you got the rest of your life to breathe. That's a great proverb, you see. We have swimming proverbs, you see how that works. And I can say when the kid's face is starting to blue and you can see it on their shoulders, you can pinch
point their shoulders and there's lack of oxygen there, I can say, yeah, that's the way it's supposed to feel. I can also tell them, you know, if you don't put it out in the pool, stay on the deck. We have proverbs that way. You understand that your main competition isn't in the pool when you're practicing. It's somewhere else in the state. You got to practice. Don't give in to the pain. Why? Because I've been there. I can't swim the stroke as it's done now, but I know the mindset. Some of you may not be able to surf the internet with younger people, but you know how people function. And it's incumbent on you not to let your technical incompetence get in the way of the wisdom you have to share with people. And Solomon's concerned in the midst of a culture that's in free fall. There's so much wealth, so much exotic stuff coming into it, so many things coming into 10th century BC Israel that he's concerned that his kids are going to go the way of pleasure versus the way of principle, that he says, pursue. Gain wisdom. And I implore you all not to give up on learning how to be wise and how to transfer it to other folk. I don't know what your parables or proverbs are, but you've got to hold on to them and transfer them to other folk. Solomon goes on then to say what his ultimate purpose is. And time's going and we've got to look at it. This is the central core. It's the thesis of the book, verse 7. He says, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and discipline. The word beginning here is not beginning in the sense of chronology. The word beginning has to do with the sense of the core issue, the foundation for something. If you want to get at the heart of where wisdom comes, it comes in the reverential trust and awe of God. It becomes the center point where you need to start. It's the foundation for knowing wisdom and knowledge. Note what Solomon is not saying. He's not saying that folk who don't trust God are necessarily intellectually dumb. They may, in fact, be brilliant. There are folk who are theoretical physicists and experts in other areas who know more than I'll ever know about certain topics. But they are foolish because they don't see God as the center point of life. Why? Because God's the one that created it all. If you don't come into relationship with God, then it's sort of like you're trying to figure out what the center point is. In that regard, God makes himself available to those who seek him. And if you refuse to seek him, then you end up being foolish because you've not read the signs to see him at the center. I want to get a car. I've determined that I will not steal, defraud, or be unfair. I will attempt to be prudent, knowledgeable, and insightful. But at the core of wise car shopping, at the core of everything in life, is to invite the presence of God into my life. Note how Solomon says this. He's giving it to us and will give it to us many other times. He's saying that the foundation of wisdom is not wealth. He doesn't say the wealth of men is the beginning of knowledge. Otherwise, only the rich would be wise. He doesn't say experience is the beginning of knowledge. Otherwise, the old would be wise, and there are very, very many, many unwise senior citizens. He doesn't say inherited characteristics are the beginning of knowledge and wisdom. Otherwise, the genetically blessed would be the ones that are wise. He doesn't say information is the beginning of knowledge. That's one of the lies of our age. He doesn't say power, who we control and how we can manipulate people, that's the beginning of knowledge. No. He doesn't say ritual observance is the beginning of knowledge. Where you place your body on Sunday morning has nothing to do with whether you're wise or not. We come here in order to find our point of orientation and say to the Lord, yes, you're number one in my life. I want you to be number one all the days between Sunday and Sunday. Note carefully, friends, he doesn't say position makes you wise. Otherwise, all parents would be incredibly wise compared to their kids, because they know more than their kids do. There are some very unwise parents in our world. be very suspicious of someone who appeals to your obedience based merely on their position. Note, Solomon is going to make a big point of discipline, but it's not discipline itself that makes for wisdom. No, it's the reverential awe, the awareness of the presence of God in my life that's the foundation for wisdom. And you know, friends, that's open to all of us. Regardless of your background, your genetics, your history, your wealth, your experience, you can invite God to be part of your life. And so what Solomon does at the very beginning of his book of Proverbs is he does what, in fact, Christians know intuitively, that they invite Jesus to become part of their life. It's real easy to say it. It's a much difficult thing to do it, isn't it? And it's so easy for us to go out of this room and forget that Jesus wants to be part of our life day by day, minute by minute. At its core, I want to call them the three R's of wisdom. Wisdom is relational, wisdom is reverential, and wisdom is reality-based. It's relational in the sense that without connection to God, wisdom is elusive. If you say, God, I don't want you to be part of my life right now, I'm going to put you into a little box. I'm going to have you on Wednesday and Sunday, and I'll have you in a couple of maybe minutes during the day, but after that, I'm going to do my own thing. Wisdom will flee from you. Wisdom is reverential. It amounts to the fact that we should fear, we should be in awe of the fact that God wants our presence. You know, folk, if you're not humble, you won't be wise. If you think you got it together, if you're proud about what's happened in your life, beware. You're a fool. Because this verse says, the fear of the Lord is the center point of knowledge. Fools despise wisdom and knowledge. Thirdly, it's reality-based. These verses basically encourage us to see that it's possible for us to know who the wise people and who the foolish people are. You can see it in the outcome of their life. And some people make choice after choice after choice that becomes an accretion of foolishness. No matter how gifted intellectually they might be, how connected politically they may be, the fact of the matter is you can see the outcome of their life is one of foolishness. Our culture cries out right now for wise people. Folk who endure the stability of their walk with God. Are you one of them? For many years, the chapel utilized the computer software program called Computers for Churches. Those of us who have been part of that shudder when we hear the word CFC. It's kind of one of the bad jokes of the office. Most of you don't have a clue about it, so I'm letting you in on a little in-joke right now. If you want to do send Linda Wright up the wazoo, all you got to do is say CFC. She'll say, what? Say Computers for Church. Oh, like this. It's kind of like the teacher scratching the chalk on the thing. You know how that made your hands like that? The program, when it was first written, was a wonderful program. But it became ancient and outdated. And eventually what happened was the program was abandoned by its creators. They were no longer given any updates to the program, but we had 6,000-7,000 files on it for people's names, birth dates, and all the rest of it that was our data. How do we get at it? That program has taught me something. Without connection to the creators of something, the natural degradation of the process of life means that we have to work around things. And one of the things that had to happen in the chapel is that when they did month end, they tried to balance the books. It sometimes took them 6 to 10 hours over 2 nights to balance it. And what was printed out, they could no longer take as face value because the program was not giving them what they knew to be true. They had to make, among other things, the people who were treasurers and assistant treasurers compensations for what the program said because they couldn't trust its veracity. You know, I find that there are a lot of folk like that. As they get older, they lose off the sight of wisdom and the reverential awe of God, and the result is people start to have to work around them in life. We make compensations for them. We put up with them, but we no longer trust their output. We got a new program, by the way. It takes 2 to 4 hours. Isn't that amazing? Because all of a sudden you can change things. And what's changed is reflected by what's seen. Proverbs comes to us as an appeal to become fresh in our relationship with God. Without staying close to the heart of God, our lives become like outdated software, increasingly inflexible, unusable, and needing to be worked around. How can God use us as a fellowship? Use you personally. In subsequent messages, we'll look at five pictures of wisdom that Solomon will look at. I've listed them on the outline. They're found in chapters 1-4. Wisdom is going to be compared and described as a town crier, as a treasure elusive yet wonderful to find, as a true woman. One of the things that's fascinating about that is how the feminine sexuality and wisdom come together in Solomon's mind. No doubt because he's speaking primarily to his sons at this point. But that will merit a special point of consideration. As a truthful tree, and throughout this book, as a trustworthy parent. We don't have time to look at all these. We don't have time to even look at them in any detail. Just know that they're coming. But I want to draw just one conclusion from this that will be helpful to us all. Solomon writes these word pictures not just to encourage us to see that there's a variety of ways to look at wisdom, but he wants to give us a portrait so we can recognize it when we see it. Now, in the last couple of years, as I've started to study both this and other things, I've started to do a kind of little habit. Whatever my study Bible is, and this is a relatively new one, I carry pictures of my kids. See? Like this. Isn't she a doll? That's my daughter. Yeah. I got her there. And I've got my son, you know. What a handsome devil. He looks like his mother. You know how that works. You know how that, I have even had the other one there somewhere. Here he is. He's away at school. I do it for a couple of reasons. One is when I open my Bible, it encourages me to pray for my kids. You see? And I look at those pictures and I think they're great pictures. But you know, friends, I don't love the picture. What do I love? What the picture represents. Right? Solomon gives us portraits of wisdom. He gives us words of wisdom, not so that we'll love the picture, but that we'll love what stands behind the picture. God gives us a book, not that we'll love the book, but we'll love what stands behind the book. Solomon gives us Proverbs, not so that we'll be wise, but that we'll be in touch with the Lord of wisdom. That's what 1:7 is all about. It's the fear of the Lord. It's relationship with God in the day in and day out stuff of life that makes for knowledge and wisdom. Do you know him? Do you walk with him? Is he the companion of your soul? Otherwise, any study of this book, any experience in this church, anything you do is foolish because you're out of touch with the Lord God himself. In the face of his word, are you in awe, in fear of God? The rest of the study will talk about a myriad of examples, a myriad of situations, will encourage us even to think in a particular way. But it means nothing, friends. It means nothing if God does not go with us. Because you can heap up the illustrations until you are tired of doing it. You can make your own proverbs, your own stories, your own pictures until you're blue in the face. But there will be some situations in life that are not covered in this book. Who do you go to at that point? You go to the Lord himself, because he is the basis. He's the center point for wisdom and knowledge.